Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sahir Francis of the Adamar Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association based in the West Bank, who talks about what was won by Palestinian hunger strikers in their campaign to improve conditions inside Israeli prisons. Andrew Gavin Marshall, an independent researcher and writer based in Montreal, who discusses the massive student strike across Canada's Quebec province and its connections with anti-austerity movements worldwide. And Richard Kirsch, formerly with the group Healthcare for America Now, who assesses how the Supreme Court's decision on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act in June will affect the future of healthcare reform in America. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
According to Human Rights Watch, the Central Asian nation of Uzbekistan, located on the northern border of Afghanistan, is one of the most repressive regimes in the world today. Uzbek President Islam Karimov is a former top Soviet official and rules with a heavy hand. Few international non-governmental organizations or independent journalists can operate in Uzbekistan, a country of 28 million people. Since Pakistan blocked supply routes into Afghanistan, NATO has used Uzbekistan as a vital transit center to truck fuel, military equipment, and other basic goods to troops fighting in the Afghan war. Closer ties between the U.S., European Union, and Uzbekistan came despite the Karimov regime's record of human rights abuses, including forced child labor, repression of independent media, and religious groups. In late February, a prisoner convicted of religious crimes died while in Uzbek government custody. Human rights activists say he died after being tortured. Two opposition journalists have been imprisoned in Uzbekistan since 1999, longer than any other reporters across the globe. In January, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton signed a waiver lifting a human rights ban on military aid to Uzbekistan, providing $1.5 million to the Karimov government to buy non-lethal military aid used to protect NATO's Afghan supply lines. The simmering rift over who controls the South China Sea is heating up as China and the Philippines quarrel over the Scarborough Shoal, located 500 miles off the coast of mainland China, claimed by both nations. The dispute resurfaced on April 10th when a Philippine Navy ship tried to arrest a Chinese fisherman who was working near the shoal. Then a mini-trade war broke out as China blocked banana imports from the Philippines and stopped Chinese tourists from visiting the Philippines. In late May, the Philippines complained that China had sent over 100 commercial ships near the disputed island. In response, over 500 people marched on the Chinese embassy in Manila. Rising tensions in the South China Sea reflect growing competition among Asian nations over control of vital ocean trade routes, in addition to rich oil and gas reserves and fisheries. China, Vietnam, and the Philippines have held a series of talks to settle their territorial disputes and issues relating to access to resources. And in recent months, the Obama administration has adjusted its national security strategy to focus on China's growing military power in the Pacific region. Recently released California inmate Jason Corrales dressed up for a job interview at a Trader Joe's store in the fashionable Los Angeles West Side. The job application asked for information on felony convictions. Once a member of an East L.A. street gang, Corrales has been in state prison since he was 17 for killing a member of a rival gang in a drive-by shooting. According to the Christian Science Monitor, over 700,000 released inmates reenter society in the U.S. each year. The undertaking is most daunting in California, which is preparing to release 30,000 inmates from state prisons next year. Los Angeles County, which has the largest county jail system in the U.S., plans to release an additional 8,300 prisoners this year. The prisoner release is a major challenge for social service agencies tasked with helping former inmates find jobs and housing. Statistics indicate that many of the released inmates will end up back in jail within 3 years, mostly for parole violations. In response to the massive release, many California social workers are advocating for expanded funding for drug treatment and counseling programs that will assist more ex-prisoners to successfully reintegrate back into their communities. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
Hunger strikes by Palestinian prisoners held in administrative detention inside Israel are nothing new, but extended hunger strikes undertaken in 2011 and this year have garnered more media attention in the U.S. than previous prison campaigns. The latest hunger strikes were undertaken to demand an end to harsh restrictions put in place after Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit was taken prisoner in 2006 by members of Hamas and held in Gaza for 5 years. But even after a deal was struck last October for Shalit's release in exchange for more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, the onerous conditions in Israeli prisons remained in place. Restrictions included the prolonged isolation of prisoners, a ban on visits from family members from Gaza and some from the West Bank, and the exclusion of reading and academic study materials. Hunger strikers also demanded an end to administrative detention, where many Palestinian prisoners were held without charge or trial for a set period, often to be rearrested upon their release. Risking damage to their health and even death, individuals carried out hunger strikes ranging from 66 to 77 days. Many now face severe health challenges as they recover. All told, 1,500 prisoners participated in the hunger strike from early spring to mid-May. An agreement between the hunger strikers and Israeli authorities was announced on May 14th. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sahir Francis, a human rights lawyer and director of Adamar, the Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association based in Ramallah in the West Bank. She describes what concessions were won by the hunger strikers and the effectiveness of nonviolent resistance to the Israeli occupation.
Of course, the prisoners, they were using all the time, since the beginning of the occupation, the hunger strike as one tool of their resistance inside the prison when they fail to guarantee their basic rights through negotiations with the prison authorities. And it was their method in the past to guarantee the basic rights that they got as prisoners. And actually, in the last years, since the beginning of the Second Intifada, we can say, there's a big retreat in all these rights. The prison authorities started to impose more restrictions and commit more violations against the prisoners till the case of Shalit, the arrest of Shalit, and then things were deteriorating seriously, actually. And this is what led the prisoners in this time to demand, firstly, not the political demands that they were always putting there, connecting it to the end of the occupation and their release, but this time they were concentrating more on the humanitarian aspect of their imprisonment, the conditions, the daily conditions and the life conditions and their dignity in the prisons. And of course, it doesn't mean that they forget or they undermine the main issue, because as well the whole activities, the local civil society action that was supporting the Prisoners Act was all the time putting this issue of the prisoners with the big context of the occupation, that the release of all the prisoners should come with the end of the occupation, of course, and the issue of the prisoners is part of all the question of the occupation, and you cannot do negotiations, for example, without solving the issue of the prisoners. So I think it's very important part in the civil society movement and in the public struggle against the occupation. It was joined as well with, for example, the activism against the wall and the settlements. In most of the demonstrations, the weekly demonstrations that takes place, they were supporting the prisoners' case in the time of the hunger strike, and they were requesting to respect the demands of the prisoners and to free all the political prisoners.
Sahar Francis, was there a demand to get rid of administrative detention altogether? Was that ever on the table?
Actually, this was a complicated, problematic issue because in the agreement, we never get a document of the written agreement. And at the end, it was an agreement between the Egyptian mediators and the Israeli side. The administrative detention, it was not ending the whole use of administrative detention, but rather limiting and using the administrative detention just in a very serious security issues, and not to extend the detention if they don't have a very serious information. Because, you know, the administrative detention is built on secret information, and Israel is using it in a very wide way, and this is why we claim that this is arbitrary detention. It's not illegal according to the international law, of course. The Fourth Geneva Convention gives some space for the occupiers to use administrative detention or arrest without a trial, but there's lots of restrictions in the international law that Israel is not limiting itself to it when practicing the administrative detention. But unfortunately, from the last 2 weeks, tens of detainees that their detention was extended and their administrative detention, and the new detainees that they were transferred for administrative detention. So we are not sure that Israel really is restricting the use of administrative detention as it was agreed in the agreement in the hunger strike time.
Do the Palestinian prisoners, and does your organization, Ademir, that supports these prisoners' rights, consider this latest hunger strike a success?
It was a good result, and we look at it as a good achievement for the prisoners' movement. But still, as I said before, we have to monitor and to be following closely how this agreement would be implemented, because we can't trust fully the Israeli side that really they will fulfill all the demands without any problems. And this is why we are still monitoring closely what's going on.
That was Sahir Francis of Ademar, the Palestinian Prisoners' Rights Organization. Find links to additional information on the Palestinian hunger strike and Israeli prison conditions on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. What began as organized opposition against an 82% rise in university tuition in Canada's Quebec province developed first into a student strike and now has grown into a full-blown social protest movement in sync with anti-austerity activists across the globe. A student boycott of classes, initiated in mid-February, grew to over 166,000 students on strike across the province by the end of March. Swelling numbers of students and their supporters have participated in more than a dozen weeks of protest rallies and marches, with over 300,000 taking to the streets of Montreal on March 22nd. But after Quebec's provincial government passed Emergency Bill 78, which limits the right of free speech and dissent, nearly 400,000 people marched in Montreal in deliberate defiance of the Liberal Party government of Jean Charest's attempt to suppress the student movement. The three main student groups organizing the strike have been joined in the streets in recent weeks by opposition parties, unions, and hundreds of Quebec lawyers. While negotiations between the students and government have recently resumed, police continue to crack down on protesters, with over 2,500 people arrested since the strike began in February. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Gavin Marshall, an independent researcher and writer based in Montreal, who provides analysis and context for understanding the Quebec student strike and its connections with anti-austerity movements worldwide.
The government had announced a 75 to 83% increase in the cost of tuition, nearly doubling our current cost. And in Quebec, we have the lowest tuition in the country, and actually on the continent. We pay an average of $2,500 a semester compared to $5,000 in the rest of Canada, and in the United States it's even far more extreme than that. But we also have half the student debt as the rest of Canada, which has an undergraduate average of $27,000, whereas Quebec is $13,000. In the United States, the average undergraduate debt is about $24,000. So the increased tuition cost would obviously nearly double the debt cost. And this is what really mobilized the student associations here against the tuition increases. And the student associations here in Quebec function a little differently than across the rest of Canada and in the United States. They don't really function like our so-called democratic governments, where you simply elect officials every few years and they do whatever they want. Here, the major student associations function through direct democracy. So there are general assemblies, there are discussions, debates, and that the constituents themselves have to vote and make the actual decision. So the representatives simply carry them out. They're not really officials, they're just truly representatives. And so when this issue was put before the student associations and their constituents, in large part, students voted to strike, and the strike began back in February. It even included certain student associations at Anglophone schools here in Quebec, which is a French-speaking province. This is really the issue that sparked the movement, and students became engaged, were protesting consistently. In Montreal, the city where I live, there have been over 200 protests in the past over 100 days. For the first 2 months of the protest, the government simply refused to even speak to the students. They refused to negotiate. They refused to even consider negotiating. And so the students have to take the change. And through civil disobedience, they were targeting economic centers in the city, such as a sit-in on a major industrial bridge, which brings in economic goods in and out of the city every day. Consistently, the student protesters have been met with state violence and state repression. On a weekly basis, if not a daily basis, you would hear and see and experience protesters, peaceful protesters, being met with tear gas, pepper spray, concussion grenades, smoke bombs, beatings with batons, even having cars and trucks driven into them, shot with rubber bullets. We've had several students who have almost been killed by being shot in the face with rubber bullets, the face or the head. One student lost an eye, another student lost his vision, another student lost some teeth, and another student ended up in a coma with a skull fracture and brain contusion. And especially since Bill 78 was passed, which severely restricts the rights to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, as guaranteed by the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedom, this has really mobilized the good majority of the population against this bill. And so it's no longer students protesting. You see elderly people, you see children, you see strollers, you see wheelchairs, you see an incredible diversity and array of people every single night. It's truly no longer about tuition. It's about our very freedom. And the whole population is mobilizing behind this at the moment.
As you understand it, what are the students' demands here? Do they want the complete abolition of the tuition increase, or is there some middle ground you think that could achieve some settlement of this massive strike?
Well, the student association, I mean, there's three main ones. All of the main student associations agree that the hikes should be stopped, although there's some indication from the representative of the college student association that they're willing to allow for some hikes. And in terms of a potential agreement or middle ground, I mean, certainly there are possibilities when it comes to the tuition issue. But so long as Bill 78 remains in place, this will have no support from students, and the students will vote against any agreement that does not rescind or repeal Bill 78.
How important is international solidarity with the student movement in Quebec? I've read about protests in Europe, Latin America, Taiwan, and of course here in the United States. Where do you think the links between the student movement and Quebec could take an international movement of students?
The international solidarity is absolutely necessary, and it gives such incredible hope to the students here. I mean, it really started to sprout up at a time right when we were being so destroyed, and it really gave the students here strength. We saw solidarity protests in Toronto, in Vancouver, in Calgary, in New York, organized by Occupy Wall Street, in Paris. There is a student movement entering its first year anniversary in Chile, which we here are learning from. The massive disparity in political, social, and economic structures of power are not only in Quebec. These are global issues. These are global challenges, and they require mobilizing the global population against them. And the faster it spreads, the more it spreads, the more globally it spreads, the better for everyone involved.
That was Andrew Gavin Marshall, an independent researcher and writer based in Montreal, Canada. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org to find links to additional news and commentary on Quebec's student movement. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule in June on the constitutionality of the individual mandate, a key element in the Affordable Care Act that President Obama signed into law 2 years ago. How the justices rule on the challenge to the law's provision that forces citizens now without health coverage to purchase insurance will have a profound effect on millions of Americans' access to health care. Although the Affordable Care Act won't fully be implemented until 2014, supporters of the law say the legislation is already assisting people to gain many benefits they once could not afford. Among the benefits cited are allowing children to remain on their parents' health insurance policy until age 26, making prescription drugs more affordable for senior citizens, covering preventive services with no deductible or copay, removing lifetime limits on health insurance payouts, and preventing insurance companies from cutting off coverage for those with pre-existing conditions. Still, there are many who are angry with President Obama for not fighting harder for a single-payer system or a public option. In this presidential election year, it's ironic that the presumed Republican candidate Mitt Romney, who implemented a plan almost identical to President Obama's Affordable Care Act when he was governor of Massachusetts, now says that if elected, he will repeal the law. What's more disturbing to many observers in the healthcare field is the fact that most opponents of the healthcare reform law offer no alternative policy to cover the estimated 50 million Americans currently without health insurance. Your reporter spoke with Richard Kirsch, former campaign manager with the group Healthcare for America Now, and author of the new book, Fighting for Our Health. He assesses how the Supreme Court's decision on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act will affect the future of health care reform in America.
The court's going to decide at the end of this coming month, in June. The key thing they'll decide is whether this requirement that most people buy coverage is constitutional. Now, I'll step back and say you've already had two very, very conservative appeals court judges say, yes, it is. You have like Reagan's former Solicitor General saying it is. If this court wasn't so political, it wouldn't even be a question. Unfortunately, you can bet on anything in this country, and the in-trade line is that a 60% line is that they're going to say that the individual mandate isn't constitutional. And with that, probably two things that are tied to it. The most important that people recognize is a key provision in the law that'll start in 2014 that says if you have a pre-existing condition, you can't be turned down. So what's at stake? Well, first of all, there's good news. Even if they overturn the individual mandate, the rest of the law will stay in place, which means that you'll have about 17 million more people covered through Medicaid and more if more enrolled. You'll continue to have the 2.5 million young people under 26 who are covered. You'll still have lower prescription drugs for seniors under Medicare. You'll have free preventive care, which you have in Medicare and getting in private insurance plans. So you have a lot of good things that still stay in place. And you'll still have subsidies for people who don't get coverage at work or make too much for Medicaid to buy coverage. The problem is a lot of the people won't be able to get coverage because the pre-existing condition mandate will probably also be gone. And for people who get it, premiums are going to be higher. Now, for most people, that won't matter because the new law says they're only going to pay based on their income. But it will mean it'll cost the government more to cover fewer people. So, there's good news. It's not going to be the end of the whole law. There'll be a tremendous amount of good things to stay in place. But there's bad news in that a key part of the law that makes health care affordable to almost everyone in the country will all of a sudden there'll be gaps that'll leave millions of people out.
Looking back on the struggle to get this health care bill passed, what are the major strengths and what are the major weaknesses that, in hindsight, you see are a feature of what we've come up with here as we await the Supreme Court decision?
Well, the major strength is that the legislation for the first time says that there's a public guarantee, a government obligation to make health care affordable. It's not done perfectly by far. There's lots of holes and flaws in it. It's going to make health care really affordable for a lot of people, but not for everyone. They're going to still be too high out-of-pocket costs for some people. And it starts to control health care costs, but not as aggressively as it could. But still, you're going to have at least 32 million people, potentially a lot more, with health coverage for the first time. And let me stop there to underline what that means. For every million people in this country who don't have health coverage, about 1,000 people die every year. And in my book, Fighting for Our Health, I actually have talk about people who lost loved ones because of the fact that they didn't have health insurance. So So when you say 32 million people are going to be covered, that's 32,000 fewer people are going to die every year. And so the major feature of the law is that your coverage at work, more people are going to get coverage at work based on what happened in Massachusetts, and your coverage work is already improved. More people, low-income people, working families are going to get Medicaid. And a lot of people now who don't get health insurance because they are turned down because of pre-existing conditions or can't get it individual market because it's too expensive will get coverage because the amount they're going to pay is going to be based on their income. So you have a basic structure where health care is affordable for almost everybody for the first time. And that's the core of the law. Most of those things go into effect to 2014. And that brings us really to the biggest challenge we face, Scott, which is what happens in the election this fall.
How important a question will be President Obama's health care law? How important a question do you think that will be in the election debate with Mitt Romney, ironically, who, as was said repeatedly in the Republican primary contest, devised a quite similar law in his state of Massachusetts when he was governor there with a individual mandate and the things that Republicans now are contesting. But because it's Mitt Romney as his opponent, author of the individual mandate in Massachusetts, do you think that will take the sting out of this debate a bit, or do you think this will be a full-blown part of it?
I think in the presidential contest, healthcare is going to play a very small role. It'll be asked during the debate. And I don't know what excuses Romney's going to say. Well, I like it in Massachusetts, but I don't want everyone in the country to do it. But having said that, I don't think it's going to play a huge role in the election. The election is going to be determined, for president at least, really by the economy and jobs, and that's the dominant issue. And but I see healthcare as part of that because right now we're in a situation where if you lose your job, you lose your healthcare. So many self-employed people don't have health coverage. And that's all going to change in 2014. So what I would encourage the president to do and Democratic candidates all around the country do is to link jobs and health care to make it really clear that what this law is about, what Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is about finally making sure that everyone in this country will have affordable health care regardless of whether you work. And all those people who are out of work or everybody's scared of losing their job, in 2014, when the law is implemented, unless Romney's elected, you will finally be in a situation where you don't have to worry about if your health care and a job being linked.
That was Richard Kirsch, former campaign manager with the group Healthcare for America Now and author of the new book, Fighting for Our Health. Find more information on the debate over healthcare reform on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.